you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein. And this is Ecologic for September 11th, 2020.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
Today we are delving into vaccines. Yes, you have heard this talked about a lot. And really, there is pertinent news coming out on this just about every day now.
Our guests today are Dr. Abby Hafer, a biologist who teaches nursing students at Curry College in Eastern Massachusetts.
And Dr. Chuck Kaplan, a primary care internal medicine physician in private practice in Tucson, Arizona. He did NIH-based clinical research on AIDS treatments in the 90s.
It's important that we look at the science. Bottom line, that's what Ecologic is about. We can't rush the process or prejudge just because we want it now. A vaccine had better be safe and transparent in its development.
Abby brought us a Politico News Sites article about the so-called Election Day vaccine. Let's really get into what makes a vaccine trustworthy. Abby?
For vaccine research, what you really need, the sort of almost the pre-trials research is done on animals. And if a vaccine candidate is tested on animals and it appears to be safe with them and also effective, meaning that you then see that they have an appropriate response to the disease, you can then go into what's called phase one trials, which is largely just about safety. It's a small number of human subjects, but it is all around safety, kind of the old idea of first do no harm. Then phase two trials will be on a larger number of people, looking at both safety and efficacy, as in does the vaccine actually work? And then the third trial is with a large number of people from different ages, different ethnicities, and so on. And again, looking for both possible harm, but also for efficaciousness. Does the vaccine actually work? And this takes a long time. For that matter, just creating the vaccine, actually manufacturing it once you have a vaccine you like. Manufacturing vaccines takes a fair amount of time as well. And it is possible to run some of those trials at the same time. But on the other hand, and it is possible if you are willing to just shut things down, you know, if you wind up getting a phase one trial that turns out badly and you're running phase two and phase three at the same time, you just have to be willing to, you know, eat the cost of those trials. Likewise, while you are running phase 3 trials, you can, in principle, be manufacturing the vaccine that you hope will work. But if it turns out that the vaccine is either dangerous or doesn't work, again, you have to be willing to eat the cost of all that manufactured vaccine. So you can understand why companies are usually leery of doing that kind of thing, and why we need to be extra careful that if a vaccine has been manufactured, that people are not just too darn tempted to use something which may not be safe or may not be effective. So, but there's a lot of work that goes into all three of those trials, and human subjects are a very, very carefully controlled area in which research takes place for all kinds of very obvious and good reasons. So it all has to be done with a great deal of care, while on the other hand, in the end, being done with lots and lots and lots of people, because sometimes you will be looking for very rare effects that only happen sometimes, particularly where safety is concerned, because it may just be that a very small percentage of the population has a particular kind of body chemistry that can create a really adverse reaction. So this is why you need the large sample sizes in your phase 3 trials. Has this made sense in general?
So far. Dr. Chuck Kaplan, anything to add?
Yes, I'd like to follow that up by mentioning that right now, as we talk, there are multiple phase 3 trials in progress, some in this country, some in Europe, all over the world. There is actually a phase 3 trial going on in Russia right now. And just in the news, literally this week, it came out that one of the premier trials, which is being conducted by AstraZeneca along with Oxford, they had an adverse event happen to a human subject that had received a vaccine, a single person. And this is presumably in a trial with probably over 10,000 subjects planned to enroll. But it was such a reaction that they publicly announced it, and they also halted the trial. And so this has generated a lot of interest. And what it appears has happened is that a person received the vaccine and developed a condition called transverse myelitis, which is autoimmune inflammation of the spinal cord. And that's a pretty alarming discovery, because even if this only happens in, say, 1 out of 1,000 people, that would probably create enough concern that it would not be possible to approve that type of a product for human use. Now, it turns out that all of these trials are being done with different products, different types of vaccines. Some of them are virus-based vaccines. Some of them are RNA-based vaccines. Some of them are protein-based vaccines. So it's not likely that you'll have the same problem with all of them, and it still remains to be determined if this adverse event was from the vaccine or was from some other stimulus. So this is the sort of thing that has to be processed as we go through the laborious process of finding and testing the vaccine and getting it to the point where it can be approved and distributed.
Now, actually, this brings up a question for me, and maybe Chuck has caught on with this better than I have. So with that one adverse reaction, is it clearly a result of the vaccine, or does the possibility exist that it would have happened anyway? Because this is one of the problems with biology, is that, you know, people's bodies sometimes get sick for reasons that do not have to do with whatever drug it is that you're testing. But I'm wondering if Chuck has followed whether or not there appears to be a relationship there.
Well, with only a single case, it's impossible to do a meaningful statistical test on that.
Right.
So one has to infer from what has been experienced before What's alarming about this particular adverse event is people might remember years ago there was a swine flu pandemic looming in the 1970s, and they came out with a very specific flu vaccine for that and distributed it. It distributed it very rapidly, and then it turned out that it caused another neurologic autoimmune problem called Guillain-Barré syndrome.
It caused
the entire program to be shut down. The vaccine was completely abandoned. Fortunately, the swine flu epidemic in the 70s didn't materialize to any significant degree anyway, so it all ended well, except for the people that had gotten the Guillain-Barré syndrome. So transverse myelitis and Guillain-Barré syndrome are different, but they are similar enough that one could infer that there might be a connection. But, you know, a lot of this is judgment and speculation, and we can't let speculation carry us too far. We have to back it up with data and do follow-up testing to figure out whether it's really a problem or not.
And how can we trust what comes out? I mean, I'm especially thinking of the Politico article that Abby pointed Donna and I to, releasing a vaccine on election day to affect the election. So how do you know? Maybe it's a real vaccine and maybe it isn't. How do we know?
Well, in normal times, the way we make these judgments is we do the science and then we have independent review, and then we have trusted entities, agencies oversee this. And so normally we would point to the CDC and say, what does the CDC say? What is the CDC guideline? That's sort of the gold standard. Well, now we're faced with this situation where the CDC just 1 or 2 weeks ago released a letter. The director of the CDC directly addressed the 50 governors with a letter asking them to expedite distribution of a vaccine, and specifically named a distribution company and specifically named a date. But the testing hasn't been done. It hasn't been completed yet. So this is really, really out of character for the CDC to be doing this sort of thing.
Wow.
And it's clearly, this particular letter is clear evidence of political influence on what is normally an objective scientific process without a deadline. But the date that was stated in the letter is to make the vaccine available, the vaccine which doesn't exist yet, by November 1st, which is 2 days before the federal election.
We can agree that science needs to be separate from politics.
That's the message. I think we need to be sure. We don't want to dissuade people in any way, shape, or form from taking vaccinations. But when we say vaccinations, we mean vaccinations that have been tested and approved properly. So that includes all of the myriad of vaccines that we have today, such as for influenza and for measles and mumps and so on and so forth. When you start putting political spin on scientific agencies, it's just a recipe for problems.
One thing that I have seen suggested, well, Chuck and I have both discussed about how people who are able to read the literature and actually figure out what it says, you know, can do that in some cases if we can actually obtain the articles. But another thing that people could do in general in this age of the internet is, if we don't trust the CDC, perhaps we can look to see what the Australian version of the CDC says, or the New Zealand one, or the British one. I'm using ones that are in English just for ease of reading. But the point is, if there are other countries that have a good, solid respect for science and public health, if we can read those agencies' websites, we may I hate to say this, it is very sad for me, but we may be able to trust them better than we can currently trust our own CDC.
I remember giving a talk to a group of environmentalists, and I asked them, how many people here have read a scientific journal online? And I would say almost half of the people in the room, and there were hundreds of people there, raised their hand. And I have noticed since doing Ecologic, since 2002 is when we started, that journal articles are not as much in jargon as they used to be back in 2002. And I credited the people in the audience with the reason for that. So how do we find out which journal articles exist so that we can point our listeners to them?
Well, in that case, I mean, I would say the thing to do is that if there is a vaccine that is being made available, try to find the articles about that vaccine and look for actual research articles.
Yeah.
Or if you can't quite wade through those, then summaries from places you might trust, like Stat or Scientific American, which are not journals. By the way, those are secondary sources, but they're ones that are good at science. Or if you can obtain the original journal articles on that particular vaccine, I would say that would be the best way to go.
Well, I will certainly link to as many journal articles as I can find on the Ecologic website. Chuck, you were saying something?
Yeah, in medicine, there's a sort of a, I don't have it sort of in front of me to really list it, but there's a sort of a hierarchy of journals. And for really important work that has a lot of immediate public impact, it'll be published in one of the visible journals that's well known. So
it'll be Nature, or it'll be AAAS Science or something like that.
Right. What comes to my mind is the New England Journal of Medicine frequently will publish high visibility articles, the Journal of the American Medical Association, Lancet, which is actually out of the UK, and there's a whole number of other journals. But the main thing is the peer review. These are journals that have a peer review process that's very vigorous, whereas if you go to PLLS online, you know, I think there's certain online publications where you can just publish with no peer review at all. And so you have to know, I think the biggest breakpoint here is, are we in a peer review journal or are we in just something, a self-published journal with no review at all?
How do you know?
Well, you'd have to know the name of the journal and what their editorial process is. And I don't really know of a particular entity that keeps track of all of that, but I'm sure that it is something that's monitored by one of the federal agencies, but I'm not sure which one it is. Might be the CDC.
But the good news here is that for something as big and important as a COVID-19 vaccine, if the research doesn't appear in, say, the New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA or Lancet or Nature or Science, that's kind of a red flag right there, because this is big, huge, important news. And so a vaccine that works is going to be published in one of the big journals, and those are the ones that have the most stringent peer review. And for your listeners, in case they don't know what peer review is, peer review is where a scientist or a team of scientists write an article about their research. They send it to the journal, and what the journal's editor then does is the journal's editor contacts other scientists who, and their names are not revealed to the authors of the paper, but they are then, the paper is then sent out to other scientists, that is to say the author's peers, to look at the article and basically check it over very vigorously to make sure that the science was done correctly, that the conclusions are reasonable, that the statistical analysis was done appropriately. In many respects, it is the job of the reviewers to try and find holes in the article, to pick it apart in, you know, a constructive way, but nonetheless, pick it apart. If it's bad research, this is when it should be stopped. And so this is why peer review is so important, because first of all, there are plenty of charlatans out there, but there are also honest scientists who think they have done good work who, you know, don't realize something about their work that is not quite right. And this is what peer review is for, and this is what other scientists are for, is that basically other scientists make you or me better scientists because they'll tell us when we're wrong. But that's what peer review is in a nutshell. And if the reviewers do not like the article, it can be sent back to the authors with specific, you know, requirements. You need to fill in this or that or the other thing, or you need to redo this analysis. Or sometimes it is just scotched altogether. Sometimes the reviewers will just say, don't publish this paper.
I'm really hoping that we see the pendulum going the other way. And because of all the turmoil and distrust right now, that we have a whole new generation of people who do believe in science and want to counter everything that's been done and understand what peer review is. So I'm the optimist in this group here.
And I'm the pessimist. It's true.
I didn't want to say it.
Wow, time flies, doesn't it?
Is it really that time already?
Yeah, right?
Thank
you to Dr. Abby Hafer and Dr. Chuck Kaplan. For more information, go to our webpage, ecoradio.org. Check it frequently.
And you can get environmental news on a variety of topics by going to www.ecoradio.org. And you can go there today for an extension of today's show for our after the show segment. It's very important right now that we need to acknowledge the passing of an American hero of the environmental, social, and trade justice movement, Kevin Zeese. He will be missed. We wish our condolences to Margaret Flores and to all who treasured Kevin in their lives.
And Abby and Chuck, how can folks contact you for more information?
Well, you can find me at my Curry College email address, ahafer@curry.edu. If you have, important scientific questions, you can find me there.
All right. And Chuck.
Well, I will just suggest an email address, which is ckaplan@azacp.com.
Thank you so much, Abby and Chuck. One more thing. Yeah,
Wait a minute. I want to mention, I was downtown at WBAI on 9/11, and I wrote about some of my thoughts and experiences, and I already have put up a link on ecoradio.org on what was going on.
Oh, thanks, Ken. All right. Just to say, folks, we have something that belongs to you. This listener-sponsored radio station is yours. Now we need you to show your responsibility and your love for WBAI Radio and your favorite show, or at least one of them, we hope. That's Ecologic. You have choice on how you can keep us on the air. You can go to www.give2wbai.org website to get any one or more of our terrific premiums by putting Eco-Logic in the search box in the upper right corner. Or what would be much appreciated is for you to become our buddy. Just go to www.give2wbai.org on the WBAI Buddy page, and on the drop-down box, click on Ecologic and pledge a monthly amount, any amount. Think of what this show is worth to you. You have our sincere thanks.
million people, or more than 1 out of 10 state residents, have been forced to evacuate their homes as unprecedented wildfires fueled by the climate crisis continue to rage across the western United States. In California, the town of Berry Creek was completely consumed as a wall of fire swept through the community, killing 10 people and leaving another 16 missing. Meanwhile, the August Complex Fire in Mendocino County has become the largest conflagration in California history at nearly 750 square miles. This comes as President Trump last spoke publicly about the fires in August and has yet to offer any public statement of support for victims of the blazes. As the coronavirus pandemic has a devastating impact on economies around the world, those confronting potentially life-threatening levels of food insecurity in the developing world are expected to nearly double this year to 265 million, according to the United Nations World Food Program. In a crisis that is especially dire for children, according to a recent paper published by The Lancet, the number of children worldwide younger than 5 caught in a state of wasting is likely to grow by nearly 7 million this year, or 14%. Wasting means a child's weight is so far below normal that they face an elevated risk of death, along with long-term health and developmental problems. The largest number of vulnerable communities are concentrated in South Asia and Africa. A new report finds Amazon set prices for essential products during the COVID-19 pandemic at levels that would violate price gouging laws in many U.S. states. Public Citizen reports Amazon marked up some goods by as much as 1,000% over the expected price at a time when millions of people were forced to shop online due to remain-at-home orders. Meanwhile, a new Oxfam report finds Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos could personally pay each of his 876,000 employees a six-figure bonus and still have more wealth than he controlled at the start of the pandemic. According to a report today in The Guardian, right-wing Christians and conservatives are training thousands of volunteers to challenge the validity of some votes cast in key battleground states such as Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. True the Vote, which has Tea Party roots, has done training sessions with several national religious and local conservative groups. True the Vote says it is promoting free and fair elections, but independent election law experts say that historically the group has backed measures to curb minority voting, including voter ID laws and voter roll purges, and it's organized election observers who have been charged with intimidation. In Los Angeles, police fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to clear demonstrations while arresting 35 people this week as protesters continue to demand justice for Dijon Kizzy, a 29-year-old black bicyclist who was shot dead by police after being pulled over for an alleged bike violation in late August. Protesters want L.A. District Attorney Jackie Lacey to resign and for the officers involved to be fired and criminally prosecuted. The NFL season got underway last night in Kansas City, pitting the Kansas City Chiefs against the Houston Texans. Ahead of the game, Kansas City players joined arms with their opponents on the field in what players billed as a, quote, moment of silence dedicated to the ongoing fight for equality in our country. Many in the crowd booed during the demonstration.